This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, 20th Anniversary Edition, A Woman's Journey from Christian Tradition to the Sacred Feminine, by Sue Monk Kidd. This book is read by Carrington McDuffie. Dedication. This book is dedicated to my daughter, Anne, who is also my friend, and Betty and Terry, friends who became my sisters, with love and gratitude. Epigraph. Women will starve in silence until new stories are created which confer on them the power of naming themselves. Sarah Gilbert, Susan Guber. Introduction to the 20th Anniversary Edition. March 7, 2016. When I realized The Dance of the Dissident Daughter was about to turn 20 years old, I pulled it off the shelf and read it again. Now and then, over the past two decades, I'd referred to various passages in the book, but the last time I'd actually read Dissident Daughter from beginning to end was shortly before its publication in 1996. Now, as I relived the seven-year journey described in these pages, I wished I could go back and speak to the 38-year-old who wrote that the bottom had fallen out of her womanhood. With her religion and spirituality colliding into feminism and her realization of what she'd lost within patriarchy breaking through to her, she set out on a search that seemed unknown and terrifying, one she feared, rightly so, would blow open her safe, comfortable, circumscribed world. It was somehow easy to think of this younger self as her. She was me, but not me. Such is the mystery of aging, the way we outgrow our past selves, yet carry those selves inside of us. Rereading Dissident Daughter, I was struck by how vulnerable, uncertain, hesitant, and alone my younger self had felt as she struggled to wake up. I also appreciated how close she'd come to never taking the journey at all. In my novel, The Invention of Wings, my characters Sarah and Angelina Grimke, inspired by real 19th-century abolitionists, fight for a woman's right to speak, not just in parlors to other women where they've been confined, but publicly in churches, lecture halls, and legislatures. They demand to have a voice in the world and are swiftly attacked, censured, excluded, silenced, and reviled. They don't know it, but they're about to light a fuse for women's rights in America. At the height of backlash against Sarah and Angelina, as they waffle on the threshold between retreat and courage, I have their friend Lucretia Mott send them a message containing four words, "Press on, my sisters." Of course, it was I who wanted to say these words to my characters, and even though my experience in Dissident Daughter cannot begin to compare to Sarah and Angelina's struggle, these were also the words I wished I could have said to my younger self. Press on. On a spring day in 1994, I copied a quote by Anais Nin on a card and propped it on my desk for inspiration. It said, "The role of the writer is not to say what we can all say, but what we are unable to say." So began The Dance of the Dissident Daughter. As I wrote, I often paused, thinking, "Oh, I can't possibly say that," and then saying it anyway. When the book came out, it was to a little splurge of controversy. 20 years ago, misogyny within churches, denominations, and religious groups was often, in the words of scholar April de Koenig, a holy misogyny. That is, it was sexism mandated by scripture, church doctrine, or divine decree. It can be terribly hard to change dictates that come from on high, especially when God is perceived as doing the dictating. The very idea of integrating feminine imagery and language into conceptions of the divine, and of confronting the exclusion, silence, and devaluation of women within religion, could easily create a firestorm. Since 1996, there has been an evolving feminine and feminist awareness within churches, and many progressive strides have been taken. But sadly, holy misogyny continues to this day in some traditions, now framed as a separate but equal policy reminiscent of segregation, causing me to wonder if religion might just be the last patriarchal stronghold. The dance of the dissident daughter sparked heated, sometimes scathing reactions, including public accusations of heresy, boycotts of my lectures, and a plethora of derisive letters in my mailbox. One of the more memorable began, "Dear Whore of Babylon." It was the dear part that made it so indelible. In the midst of all that protest, however, came a vibrant groundswell of support from other women as well as some men. I received hundreds of letters from women telling me that the story in Dissident Daughter had become a catalyst for their own awakening. Others expressed how the story had articulated and validated their own experiences. I recall one letter from a seminary student who wrote that while Dissident Daughter wasn't allowed to be displayed openly in the school's bookstore, it was sold from beneath the counter, and that every female student she knew had carried one out in a brown paper bag. Women created Dissident Daughter groups and weekend retreats in which they met to tell their stories and support one another. After my novel The Secret Life of Bees was published in 2002, women showed up during my book talks, clutching Dissident Daughter. Invariably, they would stand during the Q&A and give little testimonials about how it had impacted their lives. And these days, marvel of marvels, I hear from the daughters of women who read the book 20 years ago. In the first introduction to the book, I posed a question. Once you wake up, can you wake up anymore? 2 decades later, it seems appropriate to ask the question of myself again. Had I continued to wake? Now, more than ever, I'm aware of the difference the procreative season in Dissident Daughter made in my life, how it went on waking me. My first experience of continuing to wake began with a longing to bring women together. Aware of how adept women can be at midwifing one another's deepest life, my friend and colleague Terry Helwig and I created workshops, sanctuaries, and symposiums for women in which they could hear and be heard. We were motivated by a need to reach out, but reflecting back upon those 4 years of gatherings with their rich kaleidoscope of voices and stories, braveries and breakthroughs, I realized that I was continuing to come into being as well. I was solidifying my own feminine spiritual ground, testing my voice, bearing witness to my story, and learning how to carry my new consciousness out there into the world. The other change I sensed in the wake of Dissident Daughter's publication was a small vacancy inside I hadn't realized existed. I'd studied ancient goddesses, along with Christian and Jewish concepts of the divine feminine. But despite that, my understanding of God had evolved into increasingly remote abstractions. Divine reality, the absolute, the one. I believed then and believe now that God is ultimately beyond any form or image. But I began to understand that in order to relate to such a vast, amorphous presence, to find an intimacy with what seemed ungraspable, I needed a particular image. I needed a sacred feminine persona that could mediate that whole huge mystery of holiness to me. My need was sort of like William Blake's vision of coming to see the whole world in a grain of sand. It was about this time, as I approached 50, that I got it in my head to go to Greece. I wrote extensively about my pilgrimage and traveling with pomegranates, which I co-authored with my daughter, Anne Kidd Taylor. It would be impossible to recount here the many ways the trip affected me. I will merely say that going to Greece was in part a search for spiritual belonging. I didn't exactly know I was seeking a feminine icon of devotion, but I began to find it in a cathedral in Athens while staring at a dark-skinned Madonna on the choir screen. After traveling to Greece, I teamed up with Terry and Tricia Sinnott to take groups of women to Europe to explore the histories, sites, and iconography of the divine feminine. While in France, I came once again upon the dark-skinned Mary, a powerful amalgamation of the Christian Mary and ancient goddesses. The Black Madonna captured my imagination and fulfilled my longing for a sacred feminine image, one that particularly symbolizes the values I revere. Compassion, inclusion, justice, creativity, bravery, autonomy, dissidence, and reverence for the earth and the body. When I returned home from France, the Black Madonna traveled with me and took up residence in my life. She became my grain of sand. Today, a painting of her hangs above my desk, presiding over my little creative precinct. Like all genuine icons, the Black Madonna is a holy archetype, providing me with a window into a larger transcendent reality. She has also become a kind of muse, inspiring me to dig deep for my creativity. She is a big world-mothering spirit who compels me to try to do my small share to nurture a broken and glorious world. I also felt a new form of creative expression stirring to life inside. I'm sure I would never have written any of my novels had it not been for Dissident Daughter. As I'd confronted the ways I silenced myself, facing my hesitancy to move beyond the confines of the world that shaped me, and slowly excavating my authentic voice, I'd begun to feel as if my writing reached some ending and now demanded a beginning. The spiritual journey and Dissident Daughter freed me, bringing an unexpected awakening. Suddenly, here came a long-dormant desire to write fiction. I became consumed with creating stories, women's stories. Readers have pointed out that the themes in my novels seem to have grown out of Dissident Daughter. I often think of what an editor said to me after reading the book in the aftermath of reading my novels. "Oh, I see now where your novels come from." I'm reluctant to limit the themes in my work to one motif. Every novel is a multiverse, but neither can I deny that at the heart of each of them is a feminine search for self, and to a lesser extent, a female community and feminine icons that both heal and reveal: a Black Mary, a mermaid saint, a spirit tree, a story quilt. In The Secret Life of Bees, 14-year-old Lily, who has been wounded by a terrible loss, goes on a search for her mother, finding healing and transformation in the household of three sisters and a Black Mary statue. In The Mermaid Chair, 42-year-old Jessie, with her marriage in disarray, goes on a search for autonomy and self-belonging. In The Invention of Wings, Handful, an enslaved woman, and Sarah, a southern aristocrat, each quest for a way to free themselves and voice their truths. Looking back, it does not surprise me that so much of what has unfolded in my life during the last 20 years began with Dissident Daughter. The communities of women, the pilgrimages, the Black Madonna, the women's stories in my novels. Today, a grandmother of three, married for over 4.5 decades to Sandy, who appears often in these pages, I feel a kind of wonder, awe at how swiftly the years have flown, but mostly profound gratitude for Dissident Daughter's readers and the book's longevity. Why has a story about a woman's struggle for awakening and empowerment lasted? Why is the quest for the divine feminine and the female soul finding a new generation of readers? Perhaps it's because this struggle, this quest, is still relevant. For all the progress we've made within faith traditions, the need to voice ourselves, heal feminine wounds, and reimagine the divine in feminine imagery persists. As long as women continue to dig past patriarchal layers in pursuit of a truer, more vital part of ourselves, as long as we strive to tap our deepest creativity, as long as we yearn to be braver than we've dared, we will need stories and the courage to live them. Press on, my sisters. Sue Monk Kidd, 2016. Introduction. I was listening to National Public Radio the other day when someone asked the question, "Once you wake up, can you wake up anymore?" "Yes," I thought. "In a way, my whole life has been about waking up and then waking up some more." This book is about waking up some more. In these pages, I've tried to tell you about the deep and immense journey a woman makes as she searches for and finds a feminine spirituality that affirms her life. It's about the quest for the female soul, the missing feminine divine, and the wholeness women have lost within patriarchy. It's also about the fear, anger, pain, questions, healing, transformation, bliss, power, and freedom that come with such journeys. I never thought I would write this book. That's because this journey is one I never imagined myself taking. I was going along, doing everything I should have been doing, and then, unexpectedly, I woke up. I collided with the patriarchy within my culture, my church, my faith tradition, my marriage, and also within myself. And this collision changed everything. I began to wake up to a whole new way of being a woman. I took what seemed to me then and seems to me now an immense journey. It was true. There had been other awakenings in my life, but no waking experience had been as passionate and life-altering as this one. Nor had there been another where I felt more was at stake. The female soul is no small thing. Neither is a woman's right to define the sacred from a woman's perspective. Still, the initial idea of telling my story in this book gave me pause. The hardest thing about writing is telling the truth. Maybe it's the hardest thing about being a woman, too. I think of Nisa, an old African woman who was telling her story for the tape recorder of a writer. She said, "Fix my voice on the machine so that my words come out clear. I am an old person who has experienced many things and I have much to talk about. I will tell my talk, but don't let the people I live with hear what I have to say." I love Nisa for that. I know that feeling. But in the end, Nisa and I told our truth anyway. The reason I went ahead and wrote this book is difficult to express, so I will try to explain it this way. While I was writing it, a nature show came on television, a special about whales. I watched them on the screen as they flung themselves out of the sea, arced into the air, then fell back into the water. The behavior, the narrator said, is called breaching. He also said it may be the whale's way of communicating when the seas get high and wild. He speculated it was a tracking system for rough weather, some kind of urgent and powerful ballet that allowed the whales to follow one another's vibrations and not get lost. With each lunge, the whales marked their course, letting the others know where they were. I thought to myself that women must have the whale's instinct. When we set out on a woman's journey, we are often swimming a high and unruly sea, and we seem to know that the important thing is to swim together, to send out our vibrations, our stories, so that no one gets lost. I realized that writing my book was an act of breaching. I hoped my story might help you find or keep your bearings, or encourage you to send out your own vibrations. In Eddie Hillesum's journal, which chronicles her life before and during her imprisonment in a Nazi concentration camp, I came upon a few sentences that touched me very much. Hillesum wrote, "There is nothing else for it. I shall have to solve my own problems. I always get the feeling that when I solve them for myself, I shall have solved them for 1,000 other women. For that very reason, I must come to grips with myself." We tell our stories for ourselves, of course, but there are also those 1,000 other women. And yet I'm aware that no two women's journeys into the sacred feminine are the same, nor is this book by any means a complete picture of that journey. It is one woman sending out her own unique vibration. Still, it's true, I think, that when a woman offers the truth about her struggle to wake up, to grow beyond old models of womanhood and old spiritualities that no longer sustain, when she expresses what it was really like to discover and relate to the feminine divine, to heal feminine wounds, to unearth courage, and to reclaim her power, then women's differences tend to give way to something more universal. Often in such stories, we find a deep sameness beneath our dissimilarities. We find we are all women, and down deep, we ache for what has been lost to us. We want to tell the truth about our lives, to see the truth through other women's lives. We want to trust a feminine source of wisdom. We long for the whole, empowered woman who wants to be born in us. When we start on this journey, we discover a couple of things right away. First, the way is largely uncharted, and second, we are all we've got. If women don't tell our stories and utter our truths in order to chart ways into sacred feminine experience, who will? It is stories women need. Stories give us hope, a little guidance, and a lot of bravery. That's why I tell my talk, as Nisa says. Such journeys may be new for you. You may want to launch out into women's spirituality, but at the same time you may feel terribly hesitant. I can only tell you, I understand this. When I began, such journeys were painfully new to me, too. You could hardly have found a more hesitant beginner, or paradoxically, a more eager one. This book will walk you through the journey. It will illumine the passages. It may even hold your hand a little. My hope is that the book will be an opening for you, that it will reassure and challenge you at the same time. I even dare to hope that something in these pages will make a tiny explosion in your heart, and that you will see the thing you've hungered for all along as a woman. Above all, take what seems yours to take, and leave the rest. Or, such journeys may not be new to you. You may be in the midst of your own transformation. You may already be exploring a sacred feminine dimension. You may be fully engaged in a struggle to exit patriarchy and come into your own as a woman, grappling with how your life has changed. In that case, this book is meant to offer you clarity and nurture. It is meant to be a companion to you. It should provide new markers, passages, insights, questions, motivations, inspiration, boldness, and meaning. And there may be some of you who have already made your great transition. Maybe you have journeyed deep and long to the sacred feminine. I'm hoping that this book will open up some new avenues of experience and empowerment, just as I'm sure, if I were able to hear your story, that your journey would give me brand new ways of expanding and understanding my own. I hope, too, that the book will encourage you to find new ways to offer your experience to other women. In the end, no matter where you are in the spectrum of women's spirituality, I invite you to weave new connections to your female soul. For always, always, we are waking up and then waking up some more. Sue Monk Kidd, 1996. Part 1. Awakening. I was trying to lead a conventional life, for that was how I was brought up, and it was what my husband wanted of me. But one can't build little white picket fences to keep the nightmare out. Anne Sexton. If we do not want to change and develop, then we might as well remain in a death-like sleep. Bruno Bettelheim. Woman is as common as a loaf of bread, and like a loaf of bread will rise. From a wall poster. That's how I like to see a woman. It was autumn, and everything was turning loose. I was running errands that afternoon. Rain had fallen earlier, but now the sun was out, shining on the tiny beads of water that clung to trees and sidewalks. The whole world seemed red and yellow and rinsed with light. I parked in front of the drugstore, where my daughter Anne, 14, had an after-school job. Leaping a puddle, I went inside. I spotted her right away, kneeling on the floor in the toothpaste section, stocking a bottom shelf. I was about to walk over and say hello, when I noticed two middle-aged men walking along the aisle toward her. They looked like everybody's father. They had moussed hair, and they wore knit sport shirts the color of Easter eggs, the kind of shirts with tiny alligators sewn at the chest. It was a detail I would remember later as having ironic symbolism. My daughter did not see them coming. Kneeling on the floor, she was intent on getting the boxes of Crest lined up evenly. The men stopped, peering down at her. One man nudged the other. He said, "Now that's how I like to see a woman. On her knees." The other man laughed. Standing in the next aisle, I froze. I watched the expression that crept into my daughter's eyes as she looked up. I watched her chin drop and her hair fall across her face. Seeing her kneel at these men's feet while they laughed at her subordinate posture pierced me through. For the previous couple of years, I had been in the midst of a tumultuous awakening. I had been struggling to come to terms with my life as a woman, in my culture, my marriage, my faith, my church, and deep inside myself. It was a process not unlike the experience of conception and labor. There had been a moment, many moments really, when truth seized me and I conceived myself as woman. Or maybe I reconceived myself. At any rate, it had been extraordinary and surprising to find myself, a conventionally religious woman in my late 30s, suddenly struck pregnant with a new consciousness, with an unfolding new awareness of what it means to be a woman, and what it means to be spiritual as a woman. Hard labor had followed. For months, I'd inched along. But lately, I'd been stuck. I'd awakened enough to know that I couldn't go back to my old way of being a woman, but the fear of going forward was paralyzing. So I'd plodded along, trying to make room for the new consciousness that was unfolding in my life, but without really risking change. I have a friend, a nurse on the obstetrical floor at a hospital, who says that sometimes a woman's labor simply stalls. The contractions grow weak, and the new life, now quite distressed, hangs precariously. The day I walked into the drugstore, I was experiencing something like that, a stalled awakening. Who knows? I may have been stalled interminably if I had not seen my daughter on her knees before those laughing men. I cannot to this day explain why the sight of it hit me so forcibly. But to borrow Kafka's image, it came like an ice axe upon a frozen sea. And suddenly all my hesitancy was shattered, just like that. The men's laughter seemed to go on and on. I felt like a small animal in the road, blinded by the light of a truck, knowing some terrible collision is coming, but unable to move. I stared at my daughter on her knees before these men and could not look away. Somehow she seemed more than my daughter. She was my mother, my grandmother, and myself. She was every woman ever born, bent and contained in a small, ageless cameo that bore the truth about a woman's place. In the profile of my daughter, I saw the suffering of women, the confining of the feminine to places of inferiority, and I experienced a collision of love and pain so great I had to reach for the counter to brace myself. This posture will not perpetuate itself in her life, I thought. Still, I didn't know what to do. When I was growing up, if my mother had told me once, she'd told me 1,000 times, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. I'd heard this from nearly everybody. It was the kind of thing that got cross-stitched and hung in kitchens all over my native South. I'd grown up to be a soft-voiced, sweet-mouthed woman, who, no matter how assailing the behavior before me, or how much I disagreed with it, responded nicely, or else zip-locked my mouth shut. I had swallowed enough defiant, disputatious words in my life to fill a shelf of books. But it occurred to me that if I abandoned my daughter at that moment, if I simply walked away and was silent, the feminine spirit unfolding inside her might also become crouched and silent. Perhaps she would learn the internal posture of being on her knees. The men with their blithe joke had no idea they had tapped a reservoir of pain and defiance in me. It was rising now, unstoppable by any earthly force. I walked toward them. "I have something to say to you, and I want you to hear it," I said. They stopped laughing. Anne looked up. "This is my daughter," I said, pointing to her, my finger shaking with anger. "You may like to see her and other women on their knees, but we don't belong there. We don't belong there." Anne rose to her feet. She glanced sideways at me, sheer amazement spread over her face, then turned and faced the men. I could hear her breath rise and fall with her chest as we stood there shoulder to shoulder, staring at their faces.
"Women,"
one of them said. They walked away, leaving Anne and me staring at each other among the toothpaste and dental floss. I smiled at her. She smiled back. And though we didn't say a word, more was spoken between us in that moment than perhaps in our whole lives. I left the drugstore that day so internally jolted by the experience that everything in me began to shift. I sat in the car feeling like a newborn, dangled upside down and slapped. Throughout my awakening, I'd grown increasingly aware of certain attitudes that existed in our culture, a culture long dominated by men. The men in the drugstore had mirrored one attitude in particular, that of seeking power over another, of staying up by keeping others down. Sitting in my car, replaying my statement back to those men, that women did not belong on their knees, I knew I had uttered my declaration of intent. That night, Anne came to my room. I was sitting in bed reading. She climbed up beside me and said, "Mama, about this afternoon in the drugstore." "Yeah?" "I just wanted to say thanks." Conceiving the Feminine Self. Poet Maxine Cumin wrote, "When Sleeping Beauty wakes up, she is almost 50 years old." I wasn't 50 when my awakening began, but I was nearing 40. I'd lived just long enough for the bottom to start falling out of my notions of womanhood. It all started when I was 38, 2 years before I walked into the drugstore. I was a full-time writer, spending many hours immersed in books. I lived in a nice house with a man I'd been married to for 18 years, and we had 2 children, Bob and Anne, both in early adolescence. I went to church regularly and was involved in the social life of the small southern town where we lived. The last thing I expected was an encounter with feminist spirituality. Feminist? What a word to deal with. I felt a secret sympathy for the underlying cause of feminism, what it might do for women. But I was uncomfortable with the word, uncomfortable with the images it carried. Overall, I'd kept a discreet distance from it. In fact, if there had been a contest for least likely to become a feminist, I probably could have made the finals on image alone. But then one September night, I fell asleep and dreamed a momentous dream. While sitting on the sand at the edge of the ocean, I am amazed to see that I am 9 months pregnant and starting labor. I look around for help, but I am on an island by myself. Well, I think, I'll just have to deliver the baby myself. As the labor begins, I rub my abdomen and breathe deeply. I scoop up water as the waves flow ashore and bathe my abdomen and face. The pain comes and goes. Sometimes I cry and feel I might faint, but then the pain subsides. Finally, I start to push. I give birth to a healthy baby girl. I hold her up, laughing with joy. I bring her close and look into her eyes. I am shocked to see I have given birth to myself, that I am the baby and the mother both. I woke abruptly. You know how some dreams are so vivid you have to spend a few moments after you wake assuring yourself it didn't really happen? That's how I felt, like I needed to look around in the sheets for a newborn. I felt awed, like something of import and worthy of great reverence had taken place. For years I'd written down my dreams, believing, as I still do, that one of the purest sources of knowledge about our lives comes from the symbols and images deep within. So, being careful not to wake my husband, I slipped out of bed, crept through the darkness into my study, and wrote down the dream. At breakfast, I took my tea to the patio and stared at the morning, wondering about this baby girl who was myself. What new potential did she represent? Who would she grow up to be? The dream was a mystery in many ways, but somehow I knew clearly that it was about my life as a woman. Despite that realization, it didn't quite sink in that this dream was signaling the beginning of a profound new journey. I didn't know then that the child in the dream would turn my world upside down, that she would eventually change every fundamental relationship in my life, my way of being religious and spiritual, my way of being a woman in the world, my marriage, my career, and my way of relating to other women, to the earth, and even to myself. At 40, or sometimes 30 or 60, women grow ripe for feminist spiritual conception. By then, we've been around long enough to grow disenchanted with traditional female existence, with the religious experience women have been given to live out. Nearing 40, I needed to rethink my life as a man-made woman, to take back my soul. Gradually, I began to see what I hadn't seen before, to feel things that until then had never dared to enter my heart. I became aware that as a woman I'd been on my knees my whole life and not really known it. Most of all, I ached for the woman in me who had not yet been born, though I couldn't have told you then the reason for the ache. When this disenchantment, this ripeness, begins, a woman's task is to conceive herself. If she does, the spark of her awakening is struck, and if she can give that awakening a tiny space in her life, it will develop into a full-blown experience that one day she will want to mark and celebrate. Conception, labor, and birthing, metaphors thick with the image and experiences of women, offer a body parable of the process of awakening. The parable tells us things we need to know about the way awakening works, the slow, unfolding, sometimes hidden, always expanding nature of it, the inevitable queasiness, the need to nurture and attend to what inhabits us, the uncertainty about the outcome, the fearful knowing that once we bring the new consciousness forth, our lives will never be the same. It tells us that and more. I've given birth to 2 children, but bringing them into the world was a breeze compared to birthing myself as woman. Bringing forth a true, instinctual, powerful woman who is rooted in her own feminine center, who honors the sacredness of the feminine, and who speaks the feminine language of her own soul, is never easy. Neither is it always welcomed. I discovered that few people will rush over to tie a big pink bow on your mailbox. Yet there is no place so awake and alive as the edge of becoming. But more than that, birthing the kind of woman who can authentically say, "My soul is my own," and then embody it in her life, her spirituality, and her community, is worth the risk and hardship. Today, 8 years after my waking began, I realize that the women who are bringing about this kind of new female life are brand new beings among us. I keep meeting them, I keep hearing their stories. They confirm my own experience that somewhere along the course of a woman's life, usually when she has lived just long enough to see through some of the cherished notions of femininity that culture holds out to her, when she finally lets herself feel the limits and injustices of the female life and admits how her own faith tradition has contributed to that, when she at last stumbles in the dark hole made by the absence of a divine feminine presence, then the extraordinary thing I've been telling you about will happen. This woman will become pregnant with herself, with the symbolic female child who will, if given the chance, grow up to reinvent the woman's life. This female child is the new potential we all have to become women grounded in our own souls, women who discover the sacred feminine way, women who let loose their strength. In the end, we will reinvent not only ourselves, but also religion and spirituality as they have been handed down to us. Nobel Prize-winning novelist Toni Morrison wrote of her character Pilot that, when she realized what her situation in the world was, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. With her new awareness, Pilot conceived herself and birthed a new way of being a woman. When my dream came, the potential to do the same rose up, only it would take a long time to shed my old assumptions and begin at zero. The deep sleep. The dream left me with a vague kind of anticipation, a sense of restlessness. 2 things happened as a result. First, I made plans to go away 2 months later for a solitary retreat at a Benedictine monastery, which I typically did when something was stirring inside. The second thing involved a journal. Writing is not only my career, it's my compulsion. I keep voluminous journals, normally beginning a new one each January, so it was revealing that soon after the dream, even though it was September, even though I already had a nice journal with months of pages left, I went out and bought a new one. I bought a pink one. Many mornings throughout October, I sat by the windows in the den before the children awoke, before my husband Sandy came in and started the coffee ritual. I sat there thinking about my life as a woman. So much of it had been spent trying to live up to the stereotypical formula of what a woman should be, the good Christian woman, the good wife, the good mother, the good daughter. pursuing those things that have always been held out to women as ideals of femininity. One morning, I wrote about something that had happened several months earlier. I'd been inducted into a group of women known as the Gracious Ladies. I'm not exactly sure what the criteria was, except one needed to portray certain ideals of womanhood, which included being gracious and giving of oneself unselfishly. During a high lace ceremony, standing backstage waiting to be inducted, I felt a stab of discomfort. I thought about the meticulous way we were coiffed and dressed, the continuous smiling, the charm that fairly dripped off us, the sweet, demure way we behaved, like we were all there to audition for the Emily poster child. We looked like the world's most proper women. "What am I doing here?" I thought. Lines from the poem Warning by Jenny Joseph popped into my head and began to recite themselves. "When I am an old woman, I shall wear purple, with a red hat that doesn't go and doesn't suit me. I shall go out in my slippers in the rain and pick the flowers in other people's gardens and learn to spit." I turned to a woman beside me and said, "After we're gracious ladies, does that mean we can't wear purple with a red hat or spit?" She smiled, but appeared vaguely dismayed that someone who'd managed to get into the group had just said the word spit. "It's from a poem," I explained. "I see," she said, still smiling. It occurred to me that October morning that living the female life under the archetype of gracious lady narrowed down the scope of it considerably. It scoured away a woman's natural self, all the untamed juices of the female life. It would be many years before I read Clarissa Pinkola Estes's words, "When a woman is cut away from her basic source, she is sanitized." But somehow even then, in the most rudimentary way, I was starting to know it. In my spiritual life, I was also a sanitized woman. I had always been very spiritual and very religious, too. So as I wrote in my journal, I began trying to put my womanhood together with my spirituality and religion. I wrote that I was mainstream Orthodox. It sounded very dull, but actually it hadn't been dull at all. I'd pursued a spiritual journey of depth and meaning, but, and this was the big realization for me, I'd done so safely within the circle of Christian Orthodoxy. I would no more have veered out of that circle than a child would have purposely drawn outside the lines in her coloring book. I had been raised in the Southern Baptist Church, and I was still a rather exemplary member of one, but beginning in my early 30s, I'd become immersed in a journey that was rooted in contemplative spirituality. It was the spirituality of the church fathers, of the monks I'd come to know as I made regular retreats in their monasteries. I was influenced by Meister Eckhart and Julian of Norwich, who did now and then refer to God our Mother, but this had never really sunk in. It was nice poetry. Now I wondered, what did God our Mother really mean? Morning after morning I wrote, starting to realize how my inner journey had taken me into the airy world of intellect and the fiery realm of spirit, places that suddenly seemed very removed. I thrived on solitude, routinely practicing silent meditation as taught by the monks Basil Pennington and Thomas Keating. Because I visited monasteries and practiced the spirituality they were built upon, people often asked me, "Why do you like monasteries so much?" I would grin and say, "Well, what do you expect? My middle name is Monk." Like the gracious lady, Monk was an archetype, a guiding inner principle, I lived by. I'd read many of the classics of Christian contemplative literature, the church fathers and the great mystics of the church. For years I'd studied Thomas Merton, John of the Cross, Augustine, Bernard, Bonaventure, Ignatius, Eckhart, Luther, Teilhard de Chardin, the Cloud of Unknowing, and others. Why had it never seemed peculiar that they were all men? I often went to Catholic Mass or Eucharist at the Episcopal Church, nourished by the symbol and power of this profound feeding ritual. It never occurred to me how odd it was that women, who have presided over the domain of food and feeding for thousands of years, were historically and routinely barred from presiding over it in a spiritual context. And when the priest held out the host and said, "This is my body given for you," not once did I recognize that it is women in the act of breastfeeding who most truly embody those words and who are also most excluded from ritually saying them. When those particular thoughts struck me one morning as I was writing, they pricked a bubble of anger I didn't know I had, and I surprised myself by throwing my pen across the room. It landed inside the fireplace in a pile of soot. I had to go get the pen and clean it off. There had been so many things I hadn't allowed myself to see, because if I fully woke to the truth, then what would I do? How would I be able to reconcile myself to it? The truth may set you free, but first it will shatter the safe, sweet way you live. The thoughts and memories I was collecting in the journal were random, disjointed. Frankly, I couldn't see what any of them had to do with the dream. It was as if I were walking around and around some secret enclosure, trying to find a way into it. I sometimes wondered what good my pacing was doing. But after leaving the process for a few days, I would be back in the den, picking up where I'd left off, trying to make sense of things. I wrote about how odd it was that at the same time I was making these retreats in monasteries, going to Eucharist, and meditating on the words of Merton and St. Francis, I was going to a Baptist church, not just on Sunday mornings, but also on Sunday and Wednesday evenings, where the emphasis was not on symbol and silence and God in the soul, but on evangelizing and preaching and God in the Word. I was a contemplative in an evangelical church, which is sort of like trying to squeeze a round soul into a square slot. It was all I could do to hold the tension between them. I had one foot on shore and the other in a boat that had started to drift. But despite the inner tension, I kept trying to adapt. The Southern Baptist Church had been the fabric of my religious existence since childhood, and if that wasn't enough, I was married to a Southern Baptist minister who was a religion teacher and chaplain on a Baptist college campus. That alone was enough to keep me securely tethered to the flock. So I taught Sunday school and brought dishes to all manner of potlucks and tried to adjust the things I heard from the pulpit to my increasingly incongruent faith. I filled pages about my life as a Baptist. I recorded the time Anne, then 8, tugged on my dress during a church service while the minister was ordaining a new set of deacons. "When are they going to do the women?" she asked. "The women?" I echoed. She nodded. Her assumption of equality was earnest and endearing. These days you will find a few female deacons in the more moderate Southern Baptist churches, but not so much then. I'd felt like a harbinger of cruel truth when I told her, "They don't ordain women, honey, only men." She had frowned, truly puzzled. That day in church, the words, "only men, only men, only men," went on echoing in my head for a good 5 minutes. But it soon passed. With a little more ripeness, I might have conceived a new female life that long-ago day. But then I was too consumed with staying in line and being a good and proper woman, something that renders you fairly sterile as far as feminine journeys go. Writing down that memory reminded me of the time I was 8 and had my own first encounter with cruel truth. I was in the churchyard during vacation Bible school. It was hot, Georgia hot. The girls sat under a tree, making tissue paper corsages, while the boys climbed the limbs above us. I could not remember how it started, only that a quarrel broke out, one of those heated boys are better than girls, or girls are better than boys arguments that 8-year-olds have with such verve. Finally, one of the boys told us to shut up. And of course, we wanted to know who'd made him our boss. "God," he said. "God made us the boss." So we girls marched inside to the teacher and asked her point blank if this was so. We asked her with the same earnest and endearing assumption of equality with which Anne had posed her question to me. And like me, the teacher was slow to answer. "Well, actually, technically, I guess I have to say the Bible does make men the head." "The head?" we asked. "That means in charge," she said, and looked at us as if to say, I know, it's a blow, but that's the way it is." I stared at her, amazed. I had never heard anything like this before, and I was sure it had to be a mistake, a big mistake. I mean, if this were true, then women, girls, me, we were not at all what I thought. At 8, I couldn't have expressed it fully, but on some level I knew what this meant, that we were less than males, and that we were going to spend the rest of our lives obeying and asking permission or worrying if we didn't. That event and others like it would eventually limit everything I ever thought about freedom and dreams and going where they took me. But worse, those events said something about the female gender itself, that it simply wasn't up to par. It had to be subdued, controlled, ruled over. For girls, there is always a moment when the earnest, endearing assumption of equality is lost. And writing about it in my journal 30 years later made me want to take those 2 8-year-olds into my arms, myself and Anne, both. October was nearly spent before I finally got around to reflecting on my life as a Christian writer, which was how I was often identified. I'd been a prolific contributor to an inspirational magazine with millions of readers. I'd written articles for religious journals and magazines, books about my contemplative spirituality. It always surprised me where my readers turned up. One time I called L.L. Bean to order Sandy a denim shirt, and the operator said she was reading one of my books. I got lots of mail from readers. I spoke at Christian conferences in churches. As a result, it seemed people expected me to be a certain way. Of course, I expected me to be a certain way, too, and that way had nothing remotely to do with feminist spirituality. After a month of journal writing, one morning I sat as usual in the den. The light was coming up in the backyard, and the maple, at the height of fall color, appeared to be on fire. As I gazed at it, I understood that while I had gone through a lot of spiritual transformation and written about it, my changes had not deviated much from what were considered safe, standard, accepted Christian tenets. I had never imagined any kind of internal reformation that would call into question the orthodox Christian woman, the good daughter to the church, or the monk who lived high in the spiritual tower of her head. The risk of doing so seemed much too high for lots of reasons, but certainly paramount among them was that it might jeopardize my marriage and my career. I finally came to this. As a woman, I've been asleep. The knowing rose in me, fast and brilliant, like the light coming now across the grass. I closed the journal and put it away. A woman in deep sleep is one who goes about in an unconscious state. She seems unaware or unfazed by the truth of her own female life, the truth about women in general, the way women and the feminine have been wounded, devalued, and limited within culture, churches, and families. She cannot see the wound or feel the pain. She has never acknowledged, much less confronted, sexism within the church, biblical interpretations, or Christian doctrine. Okay, so women have been largely missing from positions of church power. We've been silenced and relegated to positions of subordination by biblical interpretations and doctrine, and God has been represented to us as exclusively male. So what? The woman in deep sleep is oblivious to the psychological and spiritual impact this has had on her. Or maybe she has some awareness of it all, but keeps it sequestered nicely in her head, rarely allowing it to move down into her heart or into the politics of her spirituality. The awarenesses about my female life that emerged during that month were sketchy, thin, and incomplete. A memory here, a thought there, a recognition, an insight, all of them sifting around like vapor. I knew as a woman I'd been asleep, but I had no idea exactly how. I knew I was waking up, but I didn't possess a clue about what I might be waking up to. All I knew was that there was this tiny female life inside, some part of me waking up and wanting to be born. She was rousing me out of years of somnambulance, and something had to be done with her. An unambiguous woman. All in all, I had been what some have called an unambiguous woman. I didn't know this term at the time. It was coined by feminist theorist Deborah Cameron and later referred to by author Carolyn Heilbrun in her book Writing a Woman's Life. What does it mean to be unambiguously a woman, writes Heilbrunn. It means to put a man at the center of one's life and to allow to occur only what honors his prime position. One's own desires and quests are always secondary. For me, the man was sometimes my husband, at other times my father, male colleagues, clergy, or God. But at its most basic, this man was symbolic of male authority itself, the cultural father, or the collective rule of men in general. I didn't consciously recognize when I was being unambiguously woman. I'd been blind to it. Before October, I would have denied it vehemently, as we are apt to do when something true is unconscious to us. I had truly thought of myself as an independent woman. Certainly, I was not outwardly submissive. I had my career, my own life, ideas, and plans. I behaved in seemingly independent ways, but inside I was still caught in daughterhood. I was deferring to the father at the center. I operated out of a lot of assumptions and ideas, but I had no idea the extent to which my ideas were really the internalized notions of a culture that put men at the center. My independent forays and outspokenness came at emotional cost and required excessive expenditures of energy. They engendered uneasy feelings, after-the-fact worry, second-guessing, and the habit of looking over my shoulder. Living without real inner authority, without access to my deep feminine strength, I carried around a fear of dissension, confrontation, backlash, a fear of not pleasing, not living up to sanctioned models of femininity. Such ideas may have been barely forming in me, but they still packed a lot of feeling, a lot of confused feeling. One evening in early November, while the family was eating dinner, I reminded Sandy I was going away soon to the monastery for a retreat. With me gone, he had it all: work, kids, meals, house, laundry, the whole thing. He grimaced. He said, "I wish you weren't going." That's what he said. Here's what I heard: stay home, stay put, put me at the center of the universe, and allow to happen only what honors my prime position. "You know what?" I shouted. "I am fed up. I am just plain fed up." Then I left the table, with Sandy, Ann, and Bob all staring at me, their forks poised in the air. Sandy followed me into the bedroom, full of concern. "What is it? What's wrong?" I wish I could have explained it to him then in a neat, coherent fashion, but it was so new and such a jumble inside. "I don't know," I said. "I don't know." When a woman wakes up, it's not experienced in isolation. Her family, the people she's closest to, will be thrust into the experience as well, because it's not just the woman who's expecting a new life. In a way, the whole family is pregnant. Broken connection to the feminine soul. I had always prayed, though much of my prayer in the last few years had been silent meditation. One morning, though, I tried to get talkative with God, to talk to Him about the things in my journal, the fed-up feeling, the realization that a new way of being a woman wanted to be born in me. I got nowhere. I kept wondering how He was going to understand this distinctly feminine experience. I tried briefly to imagine a God like me, God as female, but it was such a foreign notion. Now, with the wisdom of hindsight, I can look back and understand what I could not really see then, that as a woman, I was severed from something deep inside myself, something purely and powerfully feminine, steeped in a faith tradition that men had named, shaped, and directed. I had no alliance with what might be called the sacred feminine. I had lost my connection to feminine soul. When I use the term feminine soul, I'm referring to a woman's inner repository of the divine feminine, her deep source, her natural instinct, guiding wisdom, and power. It is everything that keeps a woman powerful and grounded in herself, complete in herself, belonging to herself, and yet connected to all that is. Connection with this inner reality is a woman's most priceless experience. I wish someone had told me this that autumn, and I suppose that's why I'm saying it at the outset. We need to know the root problem when the awakening begins, when all is fuzzy and the feelings are confused, and we find ourselves